From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Yesterday on Connections, we looked at the Supreme Court's decision on the issue of prayer during town government meetings originating in the town of Greece. We welcomed one of the plaintiffs, Susan Galloway, and a rabbi who is a friend of hers. Interestingly, we had criticism from listeners who identify as conservative and listeners who identify as progressive. Some of our conservative listeners wanted to know why we didn't have guests to support the town of Greece. And the answer is, we did. Town Supervisor Bill Reilich joined us, but he had to join us by phone due to his schedule. We also invited two attorneys who represented the town or filed briefs on their behalf. One did not respond, the other could not join us live. And that's where the progressive criticism comes in. Because we could not get the pro-Greece attorneys live, we aired multiple sound bites from them during the hour, and some of our progressive listeners wanted to know why we didn't have a legal expert or attorney from the plaintiff's side represented. Now, look, we can strive for balance in an unbalanced world, but we will never please everyone. Today, though, we're going to address more of the legal issues in play because we are seeing some of the effects of this decision already. We welcome Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about the Supreme Court for Slate.com. Dahlia, thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You wrote a piece that criticized the justices who sided in the majority, and Justice Kennedy, writing for the majority, said that Americans are accustomed to hearing speech they don't agree with. So, for example, at a town meeting, like in Greece, a Jewish person or an atheist could easily ignore a Christian prayer. Is he wrong?
Well, I think he's not wrong, certainly. If this were purely a speech case, it's very clear that the court has said in all sorts of speech contexts, you know, we can cover our ears, we can walk away, and they've said that in very extreme, you know, the funeral protests, anti-gay funeral protests that are grotesque. You know, so the court has held for a long, long time that we are not going to censor everybody so that the most fragile listener is protected. But this isn't purely a speech case. It's a case about prayer. And I think two of the things that Justice Elena Kagan, who writes for the dissent in this case, points out is that the prayer in this case is not as it's been in sort of prior legislative prayer cases. So there's a big case in 1983 that comes out of the Nebraska State House. In that case, the people who were doing the praying was the legislators. And the court has, for a long time, since the founding, said it's fine for the legislators to pray. This case is a little bit different because the prayer was directed at the audience. So one of the things that Elena Kagan says is you have this chaplain of the month who isn't facing the legislators and saying, let us pray, but in fact facing the audience. So the audience isn't simply listening to prayer. They're being asked to pray, and that's quite different from what the court had blessed before, if you'll pardon the pun. The other thing that I think Elena Kagan calls Kennedy out for in the majority opinion is that this is a case where people are coming to town meetings not just to be spectators. So when you go to the U.S. Congress and a chaplain solemnizes the session with a prayer, or you go to the Nebraska legislature in 1993 and there's a prayer, you're just there to watch. What Kagan says Kennedy gets wrong in this case is that folks who come to town council meetings in the town of Greece come to petition their government. They are not there as sort of passive observers. They're there to ask government for zoning changes, to move a stoplight, to be honored or awarded. So Kagan says it's different when the prayer is both directed at you and also when in part of your exercising your civic rights to come and talk to your government, you either have to get up and walk out, put your head down and not pray, or in some way signal that you are not part of the group that is praying. And in Kagan's view, at least, in the dissenting view, that's different from simply being there to watch.
This case has inspired a lot of questions about the separation of church and state. And yesterday on this program, Greece Supervisor Bill Reilich joined us, not only discussing the decision, but he said that the town is satisfied. He told us that when it comes to the separation of church and state, he thinks we often don't get it right. Let's listen to what Bill Reilich said on this program about the separation of church and state yesterday.
Our fathers, forefathers, certainly didn't run from religion, and I think a lot of people get confused when they talk about the separation of church and state. The intent of that statement was to keep government out of religion, not the other way around. Many of our early forefathers came to this country because they were trying to escape religious persecution and the ability to worship in whatever faith they may have believed in. And that's what the foundation of our country has been built on. And as a matter of fact, when the Supreme Court rendered its decision yesterday, it made reference to God in its remarks. It's all through our history. It's all through, if you travel through Washington, you'll see it on monuments. It's what our country was founded on. It does not force anyone to believe a certain religion, but certainly our forefathers were strong Christians.
That's Bill Rylick, supervisor of the town of Greece. Dahlia, what do you think?
Well, a couple of things are interesting. You know, one thing is it's pretty clear if you read, and I think it's very, very dangerous to talk about the framers as though they were this monolithic block and they all agreed. You know, we certainly know that someone like James Madison was absolutely terrified of the idea of enshrining any kind of state-sponsored religion. So I think we have to, you know, sort of be a little bit careful when we say, oh, all the framers, all the founders were gung-ho pro-religion. Some of them were deeply religious men, by the way, in their personal lives. But I think that, you know, the idea of erecting a, quote, wall between church and state, well, that was Jefferson, you know. So many, many of the framers were quite anxious about, even though they were personally religious, about doing anything to create the sense that the government preferred one religion over the other. But I think the other thing that's very, very interesting that those comments really pull out is that it's absolutely true that in this case, we are in this country, we are so ambivalent about religion, because we do say, God bless this honorable court, before every session at the U.S. Supreme Court. We do have you know, pictures of the Ten Commandments literally carved into the stone all over the Supreme Court building. So it is absolutely the case that we have religious symbols and religious language pervading every part of secular legal and political life in this country. But one of the things that's a little bit interesting is that when you look at, again, the legislative prayer cases, it's not because the courts have said that's because religion is fundamentally a part of our government. It's because the courts have said we've always done this. It's history. And so even though we have clearly got an establishment clause in the First Amendment that says, you know, that the state will not establish religion, legislative prayer is different because we've always done it. We've always, from the very founding, solemnized congressional and legislative sessions with the prayer. So it's not as though the courts say this is a general principle that we're going to enmesh religious and secular life. It's simply an exception that has long been carved out, and I think it's fair to say that this week in the town of Greece, that exception got much, much bigger.
Yeah, and there is, and we're talking to Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about the Supreme Court for Slate.com. There is one part of the court's decision that does seem to have everyone in agreement, Dahlia, and that is that the Greece case will result in other government entities feeling freer and easier about offering prayers, sectarian or not. We've heard that from Ms. Galloway. She was not happy. She thinks that's going to be the result. We heard that from attorneys who filed supporting briefs saying, yeah, this is not just a Greece case. This is a national case. And there we see today on Slate, you highlighted an example from Roanoke, Virginia. Tell us about that.
Right. This was within hours of the decision coming down. We had a member of the Board of Supervisors in Roanoke, Virginia, here where I live, simply announcing that he wanted to reinstate a Christian-only prayer policy before council meetings in that area. And he went on to say, you know, this is a Christian country. He was asked explicitly, does that mean that Muslims and Jews are not allowed to get up and invoke prayers? And he said, that's what it meant. I mean, he was quite open about it. He said, in his view, what the court had done was sanctioned, as you say, not just more prayer, but sectarian prayer, that it would be perfectly fine if Roanoke only asked Christians to solemnize town council meetings, because as he read the opinion, and by the way, I think he's wrong, but as he read the opinion, the courts are out of the business of monitoring such things, and there was a Fourth Circuit and appeals court decision that had controlled what we could do in Virginia. We had to sort of say Almighty and God, but be very sensitive to dissenting religious minorities. As far as he was concerned, that was wiped away, and as far as he was concerned, the courts are not going to scrutinize this anymore. So I do think it's fair to say, whether you agree or disagree with the decision in this case, that it probably opens the door for a lot more sectarian religious prayer, but also may open the door in other cases outside just the legislative prayer context. I'm thinking of creches, before Christmas on public grounds, or questions about Ten Commandment displays on statehouse grounds. I think those cases are also somewhat called into question by the court's decision that it's just not going to micromanage the wall between church and state.
Supervisor Rylick addressed some of those points about the sectarian nature of prayer yesterday on this program, and the plaintiff in the case, one of the plaintiffs, Susan Galloway, said she feels excluded from her own town government when the meetings start with detailed Christian prayer. And yesterday we listened to a roughly 3-minute prayer in which a pastor was telling the audience that that Jesus was responsible for creating each hair on their heads, and that he wanted us all to think about Jesus as we start the town meeting. Galloway said that made her feel excluded. She's Jewish. She said she's hurt by the town's elevation of a single religion over all others. And she said others, including atheists, are as well. But Supervisor Rylick doesn't see it that way. And here is how he responded on this program to that yesterday.
Well, I don't agree with that, because anyone who would like to offer a prayer at the beginning of our meeting can come forth and do so. We're not precluding anyone. And if you don't want to participate in the prayer, you can either choose to not participate or you can choose to leave the room. That's your prerogative and that's your right.
That's Supervisor Bill Rylick. Now, Dahlia, you've written that the town of Greece scheduled essentially all Christian prayer for about 10 years. And now you've got the town supervisor saying, we're open to all faiths to lead prayers at town meetings. Does that change your view of either what's going on in Greece or the Supreme Court's decision?
Well, I certainly think that it changes the court's view. I think that both Justice Kennedy, writing for the plurality for the three justices he represented, and Justice Alito, who wrote a concurrence, somehow we cobbled together five justices in favor, but both Kennedy and Alito were very clear to say, look it. What happened in Greece, you know, Justice Alito calls it a kind of a glitch. It's a clerical error. You know, when they were assembling a list of chaplain of the day of the month, they simply failed to find anyone who wasn't Christian, and that's correctable. And, you know, basically, if it's not intentional exclusion, that's enough for Justice Alito. And Justice Kennedy, but, you know, is less apt to call it a clerical error, but also says, you know, they corrected it. Once they realized that they hadn't called any Buddhists or Wiccans, they went and fixed it. They called a Jew. And so I think there is this sense, at least undergirding the majority opinion, that it's fixable and they fixed it. So what's the fuss about? I think, you know, it's hard to read that opinion and say, wait, this persisted for 7, 8, 9 years. This wasn't something that nobody knew about. And I think Elena Kagan, when she pushes back on the notion that this was a little bit of a nothing, says this was a pervasive month after month after month for years pattern of embracing Christianity. This wasn't 2 years. It wasn't 3 years. It went on for a very long time. It's hard to write it off as a clerical error. But I do think that at least the majority in this case leaves open the possibility that intentional patterns of discrimination, if you are intentionally discriminating against one sect, then that is problematic. I think they also do leave open the possibility that if there is a situation where minorities seek to be included and they're excluded, then that really does raise a problem. So I think that in this case, it sort of slips under the, you know, this looks okay, it slips under the radar. It doesn't look okay to Elena Kagan and the dissenters. But I think they do leave open the possibility that you can have a setting like the one in Roanoke where the proposed policy is we're simply not letting anyone but Christians pray. That clearly couldn't pass constitutional muster.
We've got a few more minutes with Dahlia Lithbook, who writes about the Supreme Court for Slate.com. You can find her writing on Slate.com's homepage right now on this issue that's become a national story. And Ian Millhiser has noted that the five justices in the majority had various degrees of agreement and disagreement within their own opinions, with Justice Clarence Thomas saying that the court could have gone even further. And let me read a portion of what Millhiser wrote. He wrote, to Scalia and Thomas, the only kind of religious coercion banned by the Constitution is coercion of religious orthodoxy and of financial support by force of law and threat of penalty. Thomas would go even further. In a section of his opinion that even Scalia declined to join, Thomas writes that, quote, the Establishment Clause is best understood as a federalism provision, meaning that Thomas believes that the separation of church and state applies to the federal government only. What did you make of that?
Yeah, that's not a new posture for Clarence Thomas. He's taken that position before, and he's certainly internally consistent. He simply feels that the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment was never incorporated against the states, and that the states, furthermore, have a federalism, states' rights right to, in fact, have a religion. And he goes even further and says, probably the Congress couldn't create a religion, you know, probably, he says, not even for certain. So you can't enshrine, you know, a religion of the United States. But he has said before, and he just repeats it here, that he simply thinks that if a state wanted to create a state religion, that would be okay. And it's as I say, this is something he has said for a long time. I think it's very, very interesting that there are two justices on a Supreme Court of nine who would go that far. The other justices obviously don't join with that position. They subscribe to some version of the test that Justice Kennedy has long articulated, which is once it becomes coercive, once the state seems to be coercing you to join a religion, that's impermissible. And I think that even though Justice Kennedy doesn't make clear what coercion looks like anymore, he's certainly willing to say that what happens in Town of Greece is not.
Di, about 1 minute left now. The question that Susan Galloway had from a listener yesterday was, what do you do next? And she said she thinks that this is not necessarily over, that this could come back to the courts. Is she right or wrong about that?
Well, I think that the courts, at least in this case, the Supreme Court has made clear they don't want to be in the business of vetting prayers beforehand or punishing chaplains after.
Right.
So I think it's going to be hard to get back into court. That said, I think a lot of atheists and minority religions are quite frightened by the decision that came down. So I think we are going to see a lot of lawsuits from religious dissenters. Whether the court will take one again and change its position, that's a tougher call.
Dia Lithwick, who writes for about the Supreme Court for Slate.com, among other legal issues, thank you for taking the time to join us on this afternoon. It's been a big issue for us here and certainly nationally, and we appreciate your perspective.
Really, thank you for having me.
That's Dia Lithwick. You can read her right now on Slate.com. Short break now on Connections. Come back and change gears, looking at solving the world's health problems with a special guest here on Connections when we come right back on member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, The Amazing Spider-Man 2 is in theaters, and some of its most explosive scenes were filmed last year in Rochester. Our film critics review the movie to tell us if it's worth seeing. And we'll look at the economic impact when Hollywood comes to town. Rochester wants more big film projects. Is it worth the disruption? Leaders say yes, and we'll look at the numbers. It's coming up in our second hour on Connections.
I'm singing in the rain.
The Great American Songbook goes Hollywood. Join Cindy Miller, Alan Jones, and me, Michael Lasser, for a live performance at the Harley School on Sunday, May 18th at 2 p.m. Call 258-0200 for tickets or check the web at WXXI.org.
Oh, why can't I?
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. This week, the World Affairs Council of Rochester welcomed Dr. Jim Sherry. Dr. Sherry has worked around the world on various global health issues. He worked in Rome on the World Food Program, focusing on child hunger. He helped create the global response to HIV and other infectious diseases at the UN and UNICEF. He's guided technical support missions to 25 countries in Africa, Asia, Europe, and the Americas. Before he spoke to the World Affairs Council of Rochester, he joined us on Connections to explain what we get right and what we get wrong when it comes to understanding the biggest health challenges in our world. I will start with a point that was almost shocking to me. And in addressing the issue of health outcomes, you look at where are most of the world's poorest. And as you say, it's not where we necessarily expect. We expect the world's poorest of the poorest to be in the poorest countries.
Right.
What's wrong with that idea?
Well, the big thing is that we've forgotten big countries, and that the fact that you classify a country as middle income or upper middle income doesn't mean there aren't poor people there. And so if you look at a lot of the dramatic progress that's been made, and there has been progress made over the last decade, most of that's been in Asia, or much of that's been in Asia, and much of that's been in some very big countries like India and China, Indonesia. And so as those countries move out of the lower income bracket and into the middle income bracket, that's a very good thing. But that's not to assume there aren't still large numbers of poor people there. And there are. And so we get to the point where if we look around the world and say, where are the majority of poor people? Well, they're living in middle-income countries.
Yeah, that's one of the slides in your presentation. You said, where are the global poor located? A quarter century ago, 93% were in low-income countries. Mm-hmm. And that number has shifted, that it's a much smaller number in low-income countries and many of them in middle-income countries. And what's the implication of that?
Well, there are a number of implications there, and especially from the standpoint of how we approach development policy. As you know, the American people are very generous. They're very committed. They're very engaged in the global scene, and global health is something people take very seriously. And the more or less kind of the logical thing would be to focus the attention on the poorest countries until, in fact, you're confronted with the reality that that's not where most of the child deaths are. That's not where most of the burden of disease is. And then you have to kind of think about how you do things. And at that case, in situations like that, you have to really think about what is your partnership capacity with countries and not what is your development assistant patron-client relationship with them.
And so that it's a more complicated and difficult relationship. Do you even have a willing client in some of those cases?
Well, that's a good question. And that's where we get to the issue about what you can do as Uncle Sam and what you need to do together with other partners, and in particular the multilateral partners. The UN system is valuable here. At the end of the day, we're trying to create a pressure on governments to do good things for the people. That's what we do here. That's what our civic action is in this country, and that's the sort of thing we'd like to see in other countries. That's one of the essential pieces of a democracy. And so putting pressure on countries, the best pressure actually comes from within those countries to do more for their own populations, and that works. And to the extent that that pressure comes from their own civil society movements, from other countries in their regions, it's that much more valuable. The U.S. certainly has a role in that, but with 194 countries, we're really not in a position to be setting the tune there, especially if we kind of think about how much actual resource we have in the mix.
And when you look at the way the problem has changed, a lot of this progress has made attacking the problem more difficult, right? I mean, 25 years ago, if most of the problems, the most severe health problems, were in the poorest countries, it wasn't difficult to find a mandate, a world mandate, or a willing client to accept the help, right?
Yeah, that's right. And the types of interventions that were available to us that could have the largest impact were frankly not being used then. So, for example, if you were in the 1970s or early 80s, at that point in time, basic childhood immunizations, as valuable and important as they are, coverage around the world was maybe 10-15%. And it wasn't until the mid-80s that there was a global movement to raise those numbers substantially. And, of course, you can't do better than that. So moving those numbers up have very high impact. And similarly, with some new discoveries like oral rehydration salts that had a dramatic impact on the reduction of deaths due to childhood diarrhea. But as you start to make progress on those low-hanging fruits, you actually shift and start taking on a more difficult set of issues, and that requires a more complicated set of parts.
What are the biggest challenges, if you can put a name and a face on them now, compared to 30 years ago, as you say? What are they now?
Well, there's a lot of them, and I think this is a part of the challenge. And it depends on how we look at it. Generally, there's a tendency to look at it in more epidemiologic terms. You know, what's the specific disease entity, as opposed to let's look at it from an inputs or a resource or a system standpoint. And so if we looked at it simply from epidemiologic terms, we'd say, well, in child health, we're making progress. But now 40% of child deaths are neonatal deaths, and those are the deaths in the first month of life. And so we need to spend much more focus there, and that's absolutely correct. On the other hand, we have to step back and say, well, what does this mean about the systems that we have in place? What does it mean about how they're resourced? what does this mean about the capacities that are in countries in order to staff those systems? What does it mean in terms of educational systems? What does it mean with respect to what our own country does with respect to recruiting healthcare workers from other parts of the world? So there's a much more complicated set of parameters there, whether it's in the finance arena or whether it's in the epidemiologic arena or even just the human resource era.
We're talking to Dr. Jim Sherry, a professor of global health and international affairs, and visiting Rochester on behalf of the World Affairs Council of Rochester. Your comments there recall for me a conversation I had a couple of weeks ago with a colleague who had spent time in South Sudan, and they're working on building schools there. For many, many years, there was essentially no educational outcome possible for girls. That's starting to change. And her comment, and when we spoke about it, we said, you know, what's the big question in New York State and the United States about education? We're all debating Common Core. Is it right for the kids? Is it wrong for kids? And people are really emotional, and I understand that. But then you look at South Sudan and you say, it's a good problem to have that we're debating Common Core. I think about our healthcare debate and our own health outcomes, and compared to what you're talking about around the world, I feel like there is a parallel there, that we have so many resources invested in healthcare in this country. And we're going to talk about that in a minute, just how much and how many resources. But is there a parallel there that, in a sense, we're niggling over the details, which is good, while the rest of the world is struggling in many ways that we're not?
Well, we have more in common than we might think. And if we, you know, if we look at the kind of the fiber, the underlying determinants of health, it is. You mentioned education. It's other social determinants. So this is an immigrant country. We have a lot to do with other countries, and we have that reflected in our own health profiles. You know, half of cervical cancer cases in the United States are actually among immigrant populations. And if we look at a lot of the determinants of health, positive or negative, a lot of them come with people, with families, in terms of how they approach things. What you mentioned in education, that's a critical one. If you can only do a very few things in the world, and you mentioned educating girls, if you can go ahead and do that, you'll have enormous health benefits from that. So when we talk about what can we do about global health, we tend to think about the vaccine or the particular medicine or the physician. And what we really need to do as the process has become more complicated, as the epidemiology becomes more complicated, is to stand back a little bit and say, well, okay, what do societies need to be healthy? And they need an active population. They need an educated population. They need a population where everybody has something to say about it. And so educating girls is arguably one of the better health interventions you can do in lots of parts of the world.
You also talk about distribution of the global health economy, but really misdistribution of $7 trillion is the number?
$7 trillion, yeah. It's a big number.
So high income, 16% of the world population.
Yep.
And yet, 83% of the actual health distribution goes to the high income. So it's essentially flipped on its head. 16% of the world is high income, and they get 83% of the resources.
Right.
Is there an easy way to change that? And does that have to change for us to fix some of these problems?
I think the impulse is... the kind of natural impulse for all of us is to say, "Oh, there's a deep injustice here that we want to correct that." And I would argue that there's a lot of good in here as well. We have to kind of step back and look at what it means. You know, first off, if we look at those numbers, they're even more skewed than you may think, because out of that $7 trillion, $2 trillion of it is in the United States alone. So, $2 trillion of the seven. Is on the 5% of the population that makes up the United States. Well, okay, that's because the United States has decided that that's how it wants to spend money on its population, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. If you look at a population and say, well, population wants to spend more money on its health and more money on its education, more money on constructive things like that, I don't think that's a reason to necessarily be critical. Certainly, there's an argument for efficiencies. Overall, in the United States, we'd spend about 16-17% of our GDP on health. We also have a huge GDP compared to other countries. The global average is around 10%. But as you get to poorer and poorer countries, they spend much less on health, number one. Two, much more of that is out of pocket. And so when you get to the very poorest countries, there's very little public expenditure, in part because of the capacity of government to actually create public resources through taxation doesn't exist. And so whatever services they are out of pocket. So one of the things that we should start to think about is, well, let's look at our health sector as an industry, which it is. It's as big as our ag sector in terms of exports, and it's getting bigger all the time. And let's look at it from the standpoint of what else does it produce. And if you go to Western European countries and talk to health planners there, they're very happy to sit back a little bit and look at the innovation developed out of the United States, because the United States spends so much more on its R&D, on its technology. They're happy to see it sort out there for a few years, see what's going to be more cost-effective, and then cherry-pick that into our systems. So we do need to kind of we do need to look at our health industry just like we might look at an auto industry, that we have a disproportionately large auto industry that produces autos that it sends to other parts of the world. That's not a bad thing. And it's not a bad thing if we can look at our healthcare industry in a similar way.
When you talk to folks who have supported much of the competition in the healthcare sector, R&D you talk about, you always hear that if we reduce healthcare spending, we're going to reduce R&D. Oversimplification or fair?
That's a choice. That's just a choice. If we look at what we spend in the public sector in this country in health, it's about $1 trillion. About half of our $2 trillion is there. And if we look at the research component, that's a more organized part. If we just look at the public sector component of it, the biggest chunk of that is, of course, NIH. National Institute of Health, their budget, I think this year, is around $36 billion. And of that $36 billion, 90% is on research and 10% is on non-research, just supporting the operation. It's worth noting that the non-research budget at NIH exceeds the research budget of the entire rest of HHS. And what that means is that the type of research that we're spending money on tends to be on new discovery. It's the eurekas, the new drugs, the new processes. We spend, in relative terms, very little on how do we use the innovation we have. So we talk, and this is very acute when we look at global health systems, where we're trying to bridge what's called the no-do gap. You know, we know a lot more than what we do with it. And so that is our principal challenge in the global health arena. Is just to make good use of what discoveries we already have, while also trying to create some pressure on the R&D capacities to develop things that are appropriate for low-income settings.
What's a good example of the no-do gap at work that you've witnessed?
Well, I'll give you a positive and a negative example. In my home state's Michigan, so I'll start with that. And you know, over 100 years ago, iodine was discovered as an iodine deficiency, and very well described what it did, you know, how it affected intellectual development, how it affected a whole range of elements. And in terms of trying to put that to work on a global stage with the simple process of iodizing salt and other actions like that, took over 100 years. Now, in contrast, in the late 80s, with the discovery of the impact of vitamin A and what that did in terms of reducing child mortality, there were from the time of discovery to the time of mass, large-scale global programming was only a few years. So one of the very dramatic things that have happened in some cases is that we've substantially reduced that gap. The other one I mentioned earlier briefly, and I'm sure it's known to many of your readers, got itself on the front of Time magazine a few years ago, was the oral rehydration salts that was discovered at the cholera research centers in Bangladesh. And it's a few cents worth of sugar and salt, and fundamentally transformed how we looked at treating diarrheal disease in children. And that took years and years to to develop and years to kind of put a pressure on doing something that wasn't an IV. It was a classic case of the best not being the enemy of the good here.
Yeah.
And that's saved literally millions of lives every year, continues to. So those are some positive examples. We have other examples where, like, let's look at HPV vaccine. I mentioned cervical cancer early on. That and other new vaccines as they become available, until you can create a big market for them, you can't drive their costs down. The vaccines are very subject to economies of scale. And so the larger the population that you have putting a demand on the vaccine, the cheaper the actual production is when you partner well with industry on that. And so we have a number of vaccines that are available like that, which aren't in broad use, but could make a very substantial difference if they were.
We knew by the 1950s and 60s, thanks to Dr. Claire Patterson, that lead was a problem. Mm-hmm. And yet here in Rochester, it's 2014, and there's still work in removing lead, et cetera. And of course, there were forces at work in the industries that slowed down the acceptance of lead as a problem. But is that an example of the no-do gap?
I think it is. And you don't have to go very far to see it. You can, if you walk out of your house and walk half a mile in any direction, you can come up with several examples there.
Well, now you touched on something I think that it is sensitive to our audience and anybody who wants good health outcomes, is that there's a lure to feel injustice when you looked at the chart, when you said 16% are classified as high income in the world, but they get 83% of the resources. And there is this impetus to feel angry or misplaced about it. And as you say, okay, there are justifications and reasons. Mm-hmm. Having said that, we're not going to spend more on health. I mean, I don't think we're going to create more resources to help problems, especially around the world. So do we reallocate resources? Do we do a better job of what we have? How do we start to move forward on those problems?
Well, those are the tough questions we have to face. I think if we look at the budget numbers, it's the usual argument is it's a very small part of our budget, and of course we could increase it. Well, all right, let's leave that argument for another day, and let's look at what part of the budget is on the receiving end, and so how much one would have to increase that to make much of a difference. Well, if we look at what the total health economy is just in the middle and poor countries, that's about $1.5 trillion out of that $7 trillion, which is not an insignificant amount of money. The totality of the amount of development assistance that comes from all of the donor countries, not just the United States, but the totality of them, is around $30 billion, about half of it that ever makes it to the countries. And so we're talking about a half of a percent. And so if we can increase it by 50% to 0.75%, double it to 1%, we have to think about what would be in our 1% to make such a fundamental difference? Is it going to be fairy dust, or is it going to be actual highly leveraged money? And so that's where we have to actually think about not just what the size of the amount of money is, but how we use it. And I think that's where the biggest gains are to be had, by rethinking how we spend that money.
But no easy solution on that, especially when it comes to policy. You know, you talk about a no-do gap when it comes to medicine. How about in politics, where you understand the problem, but to actually move the political will?
Well, it's a challenge. And what we've seen, I think, is that advocacy is a powerful tool in terms of moving people on to a particular point of view. But one of the downsides of that is eventually people begin to program their advocacy. So you kind of simplify things, you articulate things in a way that makes it more compelling, and then the next thing you know, you've changed an arm, and people think it is that simple when it's really not. Let me give you an example. If we think about a big no-do gap, half of child mortality has as one of its underlying, kind of foundational elements, undernutrition. Okay, that doesn't mean it just contributes a little bit. It means if those kids weren't undernourished, they would not have died of whatever else they died from. They might have died from pneumonia, or they might have died from diarrheal disease, they might have died from malaria, but they would not have died if they weren't undernourished. Well, that's not rocket science, you know, and when you kind of think back around the broad world, it's not that there isn't enough, you know, that we don't have the technological capacities to do so, but the actual doing of that process requires a broader, different set of processes. And it's not about more boats shipping more food and new engineering of this or that. It's about some of the practical actions that are required within local communities to identify the vulnerable, to create systems that reach them, and to be able to do those things that are right in front of our eyes. It's by engagement with others, not by just writing checks.
Fortunately for Dr. Jim Sherry, we're not going to spend time breaking down the silliness that gets into the battle over Obamacare. However, I do want to ask, I spoke to a pediatrician who is leaving the practice, and she's leaving because of Obamacare. And she's not leaving because she's dissatisfied with the administration. She's leaving because she wants single payer. And she says she's buried in bureaucracy now. And she believes that if you had the president in a room and he could be honest with you, he would be in favor of single payer. And so I'm not going to ask you, should we move to single payer? And this is all much more complicated questions. Mm-hmm. But I am curious to know, because you look around the world, and as you say, this, the notion of universal health care is much more prominent now. Are there at least models to learn from, or is it two apples and oranges? I've got friends who are conservative who say, you move to single payer, goodbye R&D. That's gone. Mm-hmm. There won't be resources for it.
Well, that's a tough one. And it's a little bit outside of my bailiwick, but I'll go ahead and answer.
Well, I gave you that caveat.
So I'll go ahead and answer anyway. Let me come back to the point that it's the wealthier countries where you see the greater percentage coming out of the public sector and less out of pockets or less from other sources. And so if we look at many of the European countries, the overwhelming majority of their expenditure is from the public sector. The U.S. spends 60, 80, 100% more than some of those countries, and much of that, you know, in a public-private mix. I think to make the argument that it's because of that mix that you get the additional research investment kind of ignores the point that the principal engine for research in the United States in the health sectors, the National Institutes of Health and the other agencies within HHS, and all of that is allocated out of discretionary funding every year. So that's that resource, those investments are made, and they're a relatively small percentage, a few percent of what the overall, that overall $2 trillion that we spend in healthcare. I think what we do see in other places are mixed systems. So it, you know, in terms of being able to get to single-payer systems, and this is not an argument against that by any stretch, but you have to have a lot of things at play. I mean, you have to have a sense of social solidarity. You have to have good measurement capacity. You have to have good, you know, you have to have traditions in place on how you approach things. You have to have, you have to have a particular orientation within your medical profession, your service professions. So there's a lot of constellations like that. Increasingly, we see mixed systems. You know, not to compare with China by any stretch. You know, China has some innovative things going on, which is health insurance around by municipality. So you have individual cities that actually are, you know, for the first time actually coming up with some healthcare modalities. I would note that there's, you know, there's maybe 5% coverage in a country like China, but, you know, slowly growing. So I'm not sure there's a lot of solutions there. We're out in a learning space, and I think that's maybe one of the messages for us to reflect on. Learning doesn't stop at our boundaries. We need not vilify or sanctify systems that are going on in other places. Those systems have determinants and conditions that aren't the same as ours. But we can learn from them. We can see what they're doing well and what they're not doing well, just as our European colleagues will sit and watch what's going on in the U.S. and the technology development areas and their investments and what's going to shake out. Well, we ought to look back in the other directions, and not just north. We can look south as well, and we can see, well, what's innovative about what they're doing? How are they increasing the health impact with less money? And there are lots of lessons to learn from lots of places.
We'll wrap the conversation with Dr. Jim Sherry on this note. And by the way, he spoke earlier this week to the World Affairs Council of Rochester. He's a professor of global health and international affairs. And you asked the question, going forward, is it possible to do good and do well? And you said probably, but you probably have to change a few things, including reimagining the role of the international private sector. And again, we've been talking about some of the public sector, and I want to know more about what you mean by reimagining the role of the international private sector.
Well, this is something that both coming out of work in the public sector or the UN sector or the NGO sector or now the educational sector, it's always been kind of a mystery to me. But I'll ask students when they come in. I always, with our first year graduate students in public health, do a little poll about how many plan to work in the private sector and how many of them think that the ethics of that reflects theirs. And there are very few hands that go up. Very few hands. And then try to confront them a little bit with, well, all right, in the same kind of economic argument, that when we actually get out and want to affect what's going on in the poorest countries, that the totality of our development assistance is a percent in terms of the resources that are available. And how are we going to do those things unless we engage? Well, okay, that gets their attention a little bit. But then if we look more broadly at what the examples are out there, where do we get good drugs? Where do we get good practices? Where do we get good manufacturing practice? Where do we get, in the absence of FDA-like instruments, of which there are very few in the world, where do we actually get the assurances that what's being produced, aren't spurious drugs or dangerous drugs? A lot of that is the international private sector and its licensing agreements, its quality control, its insistence on higher standards in countries because they have to deal with their board of directors back at home. And there's in many places, and this isn't just in the direct health industry, but other industries as well, even mining industries, we see that the practices of the international private sector are not what we necessarily are raised to think they are. This is not the drawing the lines with the battles of 35, 40 years ago with Nestle's in terms of the infant formula challenges of that time, which, of course, remain at one level. But there aren't good guys and bad guys quite so evident now. And so I think we have to step back a little bit, redraw the lines. And that doesn't mean that that we don't have good standards, that we don't have good oversight, that we don't have good regulatory environments. But there's a lot of room for partnership here. And that's not partnership by, okay, give us some money because you're being profitable and we're going to spend it in a different way. But seeing what different parts of the sector do. The international pharmaceutical industry is 40 times the larger than the totality of our development assistance. And they're producing the golden egg out there, whether it's the vaccines or the drugs or the devices that are there. And so we need to kind of think about where that fits into the process and not just assume that because something is in the for-profit column in terms of how it's organized, that it doesn't have a place in our global health strategy.
So if you're successful 10, 20 years from now, those same students, or at least their counterparts, who when you ask them to think about the private sector and they have a view of derision, their attitudes will have changed.
Well, that's a high bar because I think public health intrinsically drives its recruitment from young people who are primarily motivated by a sense of social justice a sense of contribution. What I would might reformulate it a little bit. I would like to see as many students in our business schools and our law schools, and the broader parts of our education, who actually have their hands much closer to the levers of the economy. I'd like to see them see their role in this area. I'd like to see our finance students see how important it is that the international finance aspects, or which companies they're going to take a risk on, or how they approach things, that it's a big world and there's lots of good everybody can do. And one doesn't have to show up just or primarily with a social justice framework in order to contribute to global health.
Well, the Global Affairs Council of Rochester has been thrilled to have you this week, and we're thrilled to have you on Connections. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Evan. It's been my pleasure.
And our thanks to Dr. Jim Sherry. A quick note here before we change gears entirely. We're talking Amazing Spider-Man 2, second hour, and Hollywood coming to Rochester. But before we do that, I just want to let you know that on Friday night, I'd love to meet you. We're having a bit of a celebration as we've launched our simulcast with WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio, out of Geneva. And at the Ravines Wine Cellars Geneva location, Friday, 5:30 to 7:30. That's 2 days from now, 5:30 to 7:30. I'm going to be there. I hope you're there. Food, wine, conversation. No cost to you. Oh, wine by the glass you can pay for. It's no big deal. Would love to meet you at Ravine's Geneva location Friday, 5:30 to 7:30, and celebrate our launch on Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 in the Finger Lakes, all the way to Ithaca. Short break now, coming right back with a look at The Amazing Spider-Man 2, the cost to the taxpayer, the benefit to the taxpayer, and if the movie's any good.